Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Peter Del Tredici, a botanist specializing in trees. He retired from the Arnold Arboretum of Harvard University in 2014, after 35 years as plant propagator, bonsai curator, editor of Arnoldia, director of living collections, and senior research scientist. And we're talking about his book. It's a beauty. Wild Urban Plants of the Northeast, a Field Guide. Peter, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, well, it's glad to be here.
You know, it's rare that you get a field guide that you can just sort of run out of your house in the city and actually use it.
Well, it's true. In this age of the COVID virus, I'm calling it the field guide to being stuck at home.
Now, this is the second edition. When did the first edition come out?
First edition came out in 2010.
And what has happened in between?
Well, what's happened in between, when I wrote the first edition, I'd been on the faculty at the Harvard Graduate School of Design in the Landscape Architecture program, and I really wrote that first edition for my landscape architecture students who really wanted to know more about plants but didn't actually know very much. And so the focus when I did that first edition was really on urban ecology and understanding urban ecology. This second edition, I've shifted the emphasis a bit, so it's now really looking at climate change impacts.
Right.
And you know, I wanted to change the subtitle of the book to, you know, the flora of the future, but the publisher didn't go along with that. But that's really what the second edition is all about.
Well, you know, there's some really interesting ideas. And first and foremost, and this, everybody is guilty of this, basically, these plants, which are everywhere in our lives if we live in a city, are virtually invisible to us.
That is absolutely true. It's called plant blindness, actually.
And this book actually awakens you to actually start looking at the things growing in the cracks in the sidewalk and in the side of the parking lot. And it's actually a life-changing book in that sense, because it reawakens your natural curiosity on what's around us. And it also changes your attitude about these plants. I mean, most people, because they don't look at them, just consider they're a nuisance.
Well, or a nuisance at best. A lot of people consider them to be invasive species and sort of...
The big I word.
Yeah, and then sort of blame them for ruining, the environment. And, you know, one of the things that I try to sort of say in the book is that these plants are... They're indicators of environmental degradation. They're not necessarily the causes of environmental degradation. And, you know, what you see as you walk around the city is, you know, plants are responding to the conditions that exist in the urban environment.
Right, right.
So they're well adapted. So I actually, well adapted is actually just a synonym for invasive in many ways.
Now, you call cities, and this is the other thing, is to look at cities now as an ecosystem, and you call them a novel ecosystem. Can you elaborate on that?
So that's a concept that says that it's really a function of sort of the interaction of climate change, globalization, and what would be the third factor that there? It would be spacing out here. Let's call it. It's really a novel ecosystem is a product of the sort of it's the environments that human create as a result of all our activities. So, you know, it's urbanization, it's climate change, and then globalization, bringing these plants from all corners of the world together. And when you do that, these organisms and the changing environmental conditions interact, and they create new associations that are essentially have never been seen before. So, you know, the Earth is being transformed by human activity. And, you know, there's some estimates that, you know, as much as, you know, 40 or 50% of the Earth's surface has been so totally transformed by human activity that, you know, that's referred to as a novel ecosystem. So this is what's happening right now. And the cities are sort of, it's taken people a while to recognize them as novel ecosystems, but that's what they are.
And plants are part of it, but there are other things too. I've actually done interviews about urban birds.
Absolutely.
And I mean, urban mammals, and they're creating new ecosystems and new associations.
And novel interactions. And so, you know, and the thing is, it's not just all native, non-native species. There's a lot of native species that are part of these these novel ecosystems. So that, you know, roughly a third of the species in my book are native to, you know, Eastern North America. And what's remarkable is that these native species are able to sort of mix in with non-native species, both, you know, animals as well as insects, as well as, you know, mammals, to create sort of a new a functional ecosystem. And so that's the word I like to emphasize, that these urban ecosystems are ecologically functional, even though they can't be considered native by any stretch of the definition.
But are these plants now the native urban flora?
I would call them the de facto native vegetation of the urban environment.
Now, these are not, the plants considered in this book are not the cultivated plants that grow in.
Absolutely not. Although so many of them have escaped from cultivation. You know, gardeners would call them volunteers. So things like the Norway maple that was, you know, widely planted in the 1950s as a street tree to replace the American elm, you know, was so well adapted to the urban condition that it began spreading on its own. So there are a lot of plants that, you know, were cultivated at one time and now have escaped to become, you know, what conservation biologists would call invasive species. So that's the sort of this going back and forth. So they were cultivated at one point, but no longer. Now they're on their own.
As the phrase you used in the book is, they grow without human permission.
Yes.
I love that phrase. There's an interesting example early on in the introductory chapters of the book, the Tree of Heaven. You mentioned that in relationship to the tree grows in Brooklyn.
Well, that is that's the species for which the you know, the title is drawn, and you know, it's a wonderful book about sort of the immigrant experience in the, you know, 1920s and 30s in New York City, and you know, that the ailanthus tree that just grows anywhere and flourishes without resources is the metaphor. The book is really, the tree is only mentioned at the very beginning and at the very end. But what's interesting about it is that if you look at, you know, these species that, you know, many people refer to as invasive, you could actually also call them immigrant.
Right,
You know, botanical immigrants, which would totally change the whole sort of perception that people have of them. And so this is one of the things that, you know, I'm very interested in doing is how do you change the perception of these plants? And if you look at the language that people use when they talk about these invasive species, it's all about how, you know, we've got to eradicate them. Invasive. It's actually a lot of the same terminology that, you know, is used in the immigration debate in our politics. So it's really, and there's not a real recognition. These plants are actually helping to make the world that we've made a mess of more habitable.
One of the other phrases to use when we talk about weed, it's a social, not a biological construct. It's how we view it. It has nothing to do with an actual taxonomic.
Absolutely, absolutely true. I mean, in your garden, you know, you've got the plants you want to grow for food, and then you've got the other plants that you know, are competing for resources with those plants. Those are the weeds, and it has no biological sort of definition. It's just a plant you don't like or you don't want because it's competing with something you're trying to grow.
One of the things about these urban plants is, as you mentioned in the book, are driven by disturbance and change. They thrive on it, which is why they're found in these urban environments.
Exactly. And if you, you know, the history of cities is, you know, one of continual transformation, both, you know, socioeconomic, technological. I mean, if it wasn't, you know, it was really in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the automobile began to replace horses as a, or I should say the internal combustion engine started replacing horses as a source of power. And that technological transformation was, you know, incredibly significant. And, you know, up to that point, you know, all of the horse manure, what are we going to do with all this horse manure? That was like a major ecological crisis. And all these species of, you know, animals as well as plants were totally adapted to the presence of the horse.
House sparrows. House sparrows is a good example of that.
That's an ecological shift, a huge ecological shift. And the plants, you know, and animals, they need to track those shifts. And so, you know, the species that were problematic in the late 1800s, a lot of them have just sort of, they're just in the background now. They haven't gone, they're still here, but they're not anywhere near the nuisance that they were, you know, in the horse and buggy era.
Now, there's a concept I want you to explain, pre-adaptation.
Well, that's a very important idea because, you know, the city is a totally human invention, and as such, you know, there's no plants or animals that have really have had enough time really to adapt to the urban environment. I mean, there are a few examples of plants that have, you know, essentially only are found in urban environments, but when you get to the woody plants, the trees, the shrubs, and the vines, those are long-lived organisms. And so when you try to understand why is it that they flourish under urban conditions, the answer is that typically that they come from environments in nature that resemble the types of habitats you find in the urban environment. So the omnipresence of concrete and masonry in the cities, that's all limestone-based. And so species that come from areas, you know, natural limestone areas, are pre-adapted to doing well in the urban environment because of the ubiquitousness of, you know, masonry structures. That would be one example. Another would be, you know, plants that grow well along the seacoast where there's a lot of salt present in the, you know, particularly in shoreline habitats, do well along roadsides, you know, our interstate highways that are heavily salted in the wintertime, you know, for public safety reasons. So, you know, our highway edges are often colonized by species that are, you know, do well in the shoreline habitat. A good example of that is poison ivy. You know, that if you go to Cape Cod or any of our, you know, New England beaches, you'll always find poison ivy growing fairly close to the shore because it's so salt tolerant, and it does really well along all of our roadways because of the heavy salt applications in the wintertime.
This reminds
me. That's what I mean by pre-adaptation.
Well, the same thing goes from a bird world, rock pigeons, which grew in cliff environments, imported into a city, and find the tall buildings to be exactly like the environment that they came from.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the, you know, and that's the pigeons, of course, but it's also the peregrine falcon.
That's right. That's exactly right.
You know. So this is the thing. It's this issue of native versus non-native. All of a sudden, when you try to understand what's going on in today's world, that's a concept that really no longer, it doesn't explain anything because the world has been transformed. And so, you know, in these urban environments, they're novel. They're not native or non-native. They're just, they are what they are, and the species that flourish in them are pre-adapted. They come from habitats in nature that resemble those you find in the city, and some of them are native, some of them are non-native.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Peter Del Tredici, a botanist specializing in trees. He retired from Arnold Arboretum of Harvard University in 2014 after 35 long years as plant propagator, bonsai curator, editor of Arnoldia. Is that the journal?
That's the journal of the Arnold Arboretum, yes.
Director of Living Collections and senior research scientist. Other than that, what did you do? And we are talking about his book, Wild Urban Plants of the Northeast, A Field Guide. A Field Guide, specifically designed for people living in the city. You can just go out, and, as Peter was mentioning, and look in the cracks in your sidewalk or what's growing in front of your house.
Well, the other thing about the book that I consider to be, one reason it's been successful is that I take a visual approach to this question of how you identify plants, so that each entry, the whole book is based on a two-page spread. So there's a page of text and a page of photos. So there's six photos of each of the species treated in the book that shows what the plant looked like at various stages of its development in flower and fruit. And then I always try to put in a picture of the habitat where it's growing.
Yep.
So that, even if you don't know anything about, botanical classification and you don't like dichotomous keys, you can actually use the book just by thumbing through it and looking at the pictures. And, I came up with that format based on, trying to teach plants to my landscape architecture students who are really very visually oriented. So it's a book. It's got a lot of content.
Well, let me give you an example. You have a little subsection in a lot of the entries called Cultural Significance, which really goes into how Native Americans or other people have used these plants as herbals. You even have things like poison ivy. Captain John Smith was the first European to describe that plant. I love stuff like that.
Well, what's interesting about this is that, that's most people's favorite part of the text is the cultural significance. But, what the book is designed to do is help you learn the names of these plants that are everywhere around us. And once you know the name of the plant, that's the key that unlocks all this information about it. Things like, Captain John Smith. Or, the other thing that I've spent a lot of part of doing research on is, when did these plants first come to North America?
And where? And where did they come from?
And where did they come from? So, and of course the uses are part of it, but this question of how did these plants get here, and a lot of the plants were brought here for very specific reasons, and we've forgotten those reasons are, long gone. But, that's a really interesting, a lot of people don't realize that Queen Anne's lace, is actually a really important medicinal plant going back to the ancient Greeks, when, it was used for birth control purposes. Now, of course, that little bit of information was lost in the mists of time, but when those plants first started coming to North America, the people who brought those plants knew how to use them.
Now, a percentage of our urban plants in the Northeast also come from Asia.
Yes, that's true. I think the breakdown is about a third from our native to North America, about 45% are from Europe, and Asia, because Asia opened up to North America much later than Europe did, that process, there are, a couple hundred years behind, essentially. But what's interesting is that the European species that do well in North America mostly come from disturbed sort of semi-agricultural habitats, reflecting the history of Europe and sort of following the disturbance that the early colonists created as they marched across the landscape. Whereas the Asian species, most of those are woody plants rather than herbaceous plants, because the forests of Eastern Asia and the forests of Eastern North America are actually quite closely related, and our forests are much more similar to the forests of East Asia than they are of Europe. So East Asian forest species do better in New England forests than European forest species. There's a lot of biology. There's even, a touch of evolution in this.
What about hybridization?
And hybridization is something that it's only recently been sort of understood exactly how important that is in terms of understanding the evolution of plants. It's not so important when it comes to animals, but when it comes to plants, because they have a much more sort of flexible mating systems and stuff like that, that, you bring these species together, a European, an Asian species and North American species, they're closely related from an evolutionary point of view, and then you put them in proximity, and they will spontaneously hybridize, and that offspring, if it's fertile, will, you know, the parents are each adapted to a very specific set of conditions, and the hybrid is usually adapted to some set of conditions that's intermediate to the conditions both the parents come from. And in many cases, the hybrid offspring is better adapted to disturbed sites than either of the parents.
Wow.
So these hybrids of plants, that's a way that, you know, evolution proceeds. And this is what I'm really personally interested in, is how, you know, you have this sort of ecological adaptation, but over time, you begin to have genetic change. So when people who have, you know, looked at the genetics of things like dandelions and, you know, a lot of other common, you know, plants, the plant as it grows in North America is genetically distinct from, you know, the populations you find in Europe, because it's already undergone genetic adaptation to North America. So that's really, to me, that's actually heartening. That's good news, because it means that, you know, that's how plants are tracking, you know, the ecological change is happening. And I think that's a good thing.
One of the amazing things that I read in your book is that when it comes to cities, plants and city environments, they're more biodiverse than the surrounding countryside. And it's like, so you read that and it's sort of does not compute, you know.
Well, it's because the cities are so diverse in terms of the types of habitats that we create in cities. You think about, you know, railroad corridors. You think about front yards. You think about backyards. You think about parks. You think about golf courses.
Oh my God!
You know, we create this incredible array of diverse habitats. Whereas when you go, you know, as you drive, let's just say west from Boston, you know, the native vegetation is basically woodland, and you've got, you know, some agriculture, you've got some suburban yards, but you don't have anywhere near the habitat diversity that you find, you know, I won't say in downtown Boston, but when, you know, sort of the outer reaches, Alston, Brighton, Hyde Park, you know, Brookline, those are incredibly rich in terms of habitat opportunities for plants.
But it's really, and this is the term you use, it's really patchier than the surrounding it.
That
so it's like a little bit of habitat here, a little bit of habitat there with that plants and
exactly
plants
right
over here. There's another concept, and this I learned so much from this book, the idea of a cosmopolitan urban meadow. Expand on that, because I love that idea.
Well, that's my effort to rebrand to get rid of the use of invasive species, because it really, you know, in order technically to be an invasive species, you have to displace a native species. And in the urban environment, the humans have displaced, the native vegetation. We've paved everything over. The soil's compacted. We've created a new, you know, habitat. And so nothing is really native to that. And basically, what do you call these plants that, you know, flourish under urban conditions? And so I didn't like any of the terms that were out there, and I came up with the term cosmopolitan. And this would be, you know, when you have open land that, you know, may ultimately be developed at some point in time, but you don't know, you know, you don't have any plans for it in the immediate time. So here's a collection of plants that, you know, are attractive, are not that aggressive, will not necessarily become problematic, and you can get them established under these conditions without too much trouble. And when it comes time to develop it, then you can develop it. But in the meantime, here's you know, you can get some ecological benefit from it.
So you do make choices in it, though. You say, you know, you are doing urban plants, but you're going to do some plants and not others.
Yes, and
love it.
And those categories are, you know, you don't want to plant, I'm not advocating poison ivy or ragweed, because they're toxic for people. And then, you know, in the, you know, when you get into the city, there's certain plants, you mentioned the ailanthus, and there's another plant called mugwort that, you know, people who live in some of the less wealthy neighborhoods of Boston, they don't like having those plants in their neighborhood, because they're seen as they're indicators of dereliction and neglect. You know, they carry a...
Yeah, but Queen's Anne's Lace is a good example for an urban meadow.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
Queen's Anne's Lace is one that when people see it, they think, oh, nobody's taking care of this place. So you don't want to plant those either. And what you're really looking for, you know, you don't want to plant something that's going to become, you know, incredibly aggressive. So you're looking for species that are adapted to the urban environment
that
offer, you know, ornamental or ecological benefits and will sort of, you know, are relatively well behaved. That's what and the key is they're adapted to the urban environment. Whether they were here when the pilgrims landed, I think is sort of an irrelevant criteria when it comes to deciding what to plant in the city.
We just have a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you, are these the plants that are going to do best with global climate change?
Yes. You know, as I said up front, I wanted to change the subtitle of my book to The Flora of the Future. And all of the research indicates that, you know, climate change is happening. And what's interesting to me is that these plants are tracking climate change, you know. So, you know, people still talk about, oh, we got to mitigate climate change. We've got to turn it around. As far as the ecology is concerned, climate change is happening, and these are the plants that are essentially best adapted to what's happening, what we're doing to the planet. And I see them as not only are they not bad, I think they're actually, in the context of, you know, the future, these plants are going to be really important in terms of making our cities more livable, because they'll flourish without a lot of intense, costly maintenance.
My guest tonight has been Peter Del Tredici, botanist specializing in trees. He retired from the Arnold Arboretum of Harvard University in 2014 after 35 years as the plant propagator, bonsai curator, editor of Arnoldia, the journal, director of living collections, and senior research scientist. But we've been talking about his really wonderful new field guide, Wild Urban Plants of the Northeast, a field guide. If you live in a city, this is, I think, one of the most must-have books. Peter, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, likewise, Mark. Thanks for the interview.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.